Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After the Great Recession, as the U.S. slowly returns to a more stable economic footing, our guest today says it's time for lessons learned. And the biggest of those, he says, we Americans personally spend too much and save too little. We're talking this hour with author and Princeton University professor Sheldon Garin. His new book is called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the Rest of the World Saves. In it, Garin says the recent recession made it crystal clear that many of us have no financial cushion to soften the blow of a sudden job loss or a major health issue. And that's in stark contrast to what citizens in many other developed nations do, Germany, France, Japan, South Korea, to name a few. Garin says these countries deliberately support institutions, policies, and cultural messages that all promote what he calls a more balanced approach toward consumption and thrift. Today in The Exchange, why we Americans tend to live beyond our means and the impact on our economic future. Let's hear from you, too. Do you see yourself or others around you living beyond their means? Why do you think that's the case? And what might encourage more people to save? Also, if you're not originally from this country, what were the cultural attitudes towards savings in your homeland? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And joining us from Princeton is Professor Sheldon Garin. And Professor Garin, it's great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura. It's great to be on your show.
Well, before we cast our eyes overseas, let's just look at ourselves first. And you write, Professor Garin, that we weren't always like this. You know, a nation told to go out and buy because it'll help the economy. How did we used to be different?
Well, when we used to be different wasn't actually that long ago, particularly during World War II and their big savings campaigns. And in the decades after World War II, we were fairly good savers. During World War II, we were great savers, but then everybody was. You were saving for the war effort. But even after the war ended, Americans between about 1946 and the 1980s were, if you measure their personal savings rate, in other words, what they save out of their disposable income, we were saving between about 7 and 11%, which was below what the Germans were doing, below what the Japanese or the French were doing, but it was a pretty good savings rate. And then we really lost that habit of saving sometime in the late 1980s and the 90s and the early 2000s when our savings rate plummeted and went down to nearly zero by 2005.
Wow, I didn't realize that as late as the 80s, we were still pretty good savers.
We were, and that's a surprise. In fact, before the two world wars, some Americans were very good savers, but lots of Americans before 1910 did not have a basic savings account or a checking account. And that was a marked contrast to the rest of the advancing world at the time, whether the Japanese or the Europeans, who might have 35 or 40% of their population with savings accounts. In America, it was no more than about 16% in 1910. Lots of Americans, particularly in the southern and western states, had no access to a savings account whatsoever. So in a sense, we've had problems with our saving going way back. But this World War II and post-war period was an anomaly. That was our golden age of saving.
So what happened? When did this balance, I mean, you said it got out of whack, you know, late 80s, early 90s, but why?
Well, lots of things happened in the 1980s. In a sense, it was a perfect storm for consumption and for consumer borrowing. Some of the things that happened, Americans don't think about because they're so natural today. But before 1980, very few Americans had credit cards. And then around 1980, as a result of a Supreme Court ruling, credit card industry was deregulated. In other words, they escaped the control of state usury laws and they could charge any interest rate they wanted on unpaid balances. So the credit card industry found that they were making enormous profits by first getting middle-income customers and then lower-income customers, particularly those customers who wouldn't pay back. So the credit card industry, that's when they started sending out these, you know, these 10 solicitations every 2 days. This started in the 1980s and 90s. So credit cards deregulated was one thing. Another thing concerned homeowners. Another thing we take for granted is the home equity loan. In other words, your second mortgage when you borrow against the equity in your home. That, too, really didn't exist before the 1980s. And then there was a 1986 tax reform, a big tax reform. And It removed the tax exemption for most forms of borrowing, but it left two exceptions: the basic home mortgage, which of course remains tax deductible, but the home equity loan, which really wasn't known much until then. And once banks realized that the home equity loan was the one form of credit other than home mortgage that was tax deductible, the finance industry went crazy in terms of offering, you know, these very favorable rates and very favorable terms for home equity loans and encouraging people to tap the equity in their home more and more. So by the 90s, when housing prices rise, you know, about 10% a year after 1995, homeowners started really draining the equity out of their homes by borrowing huge amounts of money. So basically, you put those together, Americans reached the conclusion by the 1990s, well, why would you bother to save when you could get money so easily by borrowing?
Well, and also in the 90s, we saw huge run-ups in the stock market. So why put your money in a pokey little savings account when you can make, you know, 10, 20, 30% on stocks?
Well, there certainly was that, too. Now, the stock market was much more uneven than the home price market. The home prices just went up and up and up until sometime in about 2006. The stock market was actually volatile. So it's a little surprising that Americans didn't become more gun-shy of it. But it actually remains the case that most Americans don't have that much money in the stock market, but they do have a lot of money in their homes.
Well, and we also saw a shift over this time period from old-fashioned pensions to 401ks, which put money in the stock market, mutual funds, which invest in the stock market. And I want to ask you a question, just sort of stepping back, Professor Guerin. When you talk about savings, what are we talking about today when we talk about savings? Are we talking about old-fashioned savings accounts? Are we talking about socking it away in a mattress? Are we talking about 401ks, which aren't traditional savings? You know, it is invested somewhere.
Well, that's right. And I mean, savings has always had a broad definition, and it does include investment. People sometimes don't realize that. But if you buy a stock, and certainly if you put your money in a retirement savings plan, that's all savings. Anything you don't consume is savings. But you're right. A mentality shifted, again, sometime around the late 1980s, particularly in a period when you had the advent of money market funds rather than simple bank accounts, you know, that were offering more interest. People also began to think of themselves, rather than savers, they began to think of themselves by the late 1980s as investors. The problem was that most Americans were not actually very good investors. They didn't understand risk very well. Lots of Americans found that investing in the stock market is not a particularly good way of doing things if you might need the money next year for college or for a car repair or something like that. So there has to be short-term saving as well as retirement savings. And Americans kind of lost sight of what used to be called the small savings, having liquid savings that you could tap when you needed it.
Well, yeah, what options do you have nowadays? I mean, if you're, you know, fiscally conservative and you don't want to put your, let's say you get, you know, $10,000 when your grandmother dies or something, and you don't want to have the chance of losing that $10,000 investing it in stocks, what options do you have for that $10,000 these days besides, you know, again, stuffing it under your bed?
Well, if you are risk averse, you probably are going to put it into a bank right now, because savers do historically and now they seek safety, particularly when they get scared. And Americans, as you just suggest, are scared now. Now, some Americans are returning to the stock market. Some are returning to the home market. But most, I think, are sitting tight, realizing that if their principal is largely preserved, although inflation might eat away at it slightly, they might be better off, that safety might actually be more important right now than rates of return. Hopefully, interest rates will go up again and people will feel a little less frustrated about their options.
Because right now, interest rates are so rock bottom that, you know, you really don't get anything putting in a traditional account.
No, but you get your money back.
Well, right. Exactly. Let me invite our listeners to join us, Professor Guerin, and then lots more questions. Our number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest today is Princeton Professor Sheldon Guerin. His new book is called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the Rest of the World Saves. Do you see yourself or some in your circle of family and friends living beyond their means? Why do you think that's the case? What do you think might encourage Americans to save more? And again, if you're not originally from this country, what were the cultural attitudes toward consumption and thrift in your homeland? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange at NHPR.com. thriftbook.org. And Professor Guerin, we have to talk about what's called the paradox of thrift, the idea that while it's great for individuals to save, it's bad for the overall economy. If I'm not saving, I'm going to go out to eat in downtown Concord. I'm going to see a movie. And that helps the people who run the restaurants and the movie theater.
Yes. I mean, that is the paradox of thrift. I think it's a concept that has been very much exaggerated in the public understanding. First of all, I want to make it very clear to your listeners that I'm not telling them to go cold turkey and to become misers and not spend anything. Obviously, consumer spending is enormously important to the economy. It's about 70% of the GDP. We're not talking about an all or nothing approach here. We're talking about a balance between your saving and your spending. Now, the paradox of thrift itself, this was first proposed in the 30s by John Maynard Keynes. He was worried about a depression at the time, and he wanted people not to simply stop spending. But he also really, the paradox of thrift for Keynes was, he realized that most people in the 30s in the Depression really didn't have the wherewithal to go on a spending spree. They were destitute. They had no jobs. So he really saw that the main source of the spending would be government spending. So he was really the believer in the government stimulus. So he wasn't really telling people to go further and further in debt and to destroy their homes just to be able to go shopping. He was saying government had to step in, get the economy started, then the consumers would spend. So Americans sometimes don't understand that. But the other problem with the paradox of thrift is it doesn't take account of the social consequences of going deeply into debt to spend. And what's happened in the United States since 2008 is we went so excessively in the direction of spending rather than saving that now we have millions of households who are underwater in terms of their mortgage payments, are deeply in debt, who don't have more than a few hundred dollars in liquid saving. And now the problem is we can't get them to spend. So if you go so far into debt and spending, you can't restart spending.
All right. We will start hearing from our listeners after a short break. Take some of your calls at 1-800-892-6477. We've also got some comments going on our Facebook page, so I'll share those with you when we come back. Stay with us.
Good morning, it's 919, and support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Bruss Construction, proud partner of Lakes Region Community Services, and the energy renovation of the Laconia Federal Building, online at brussconstruction.com. In Hearing Solutions New England, where audiologists diagnose hearing loss and dispense hearing aids, in Nashua, Manchester, Concord, and online at hearingsolutionsne.com. More on America Beyond Our Means on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, new efforts to bail out Greece. New Hampshire weather today, partly sunny with high temperatures from 35 in the North Country, 40 in central parts of the state, 40 to 45 in southern New Hampshire. Tonight, cloudy with some scattered rain and snow showers in the North Country, lows tonight near 25. Mostly cloudy, a chance of a shower in central and southern New Hampshire, lows there around 30 degrees. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at the spending and saving habits of Americans, especially compared to other advanced nations. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Sheldon Guerin, a Princeton University professor. His new book is called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also join us on our Facebook page. And Professor Guerin, here's a comment from our Facebook page from Lucy, who says, we've been running our economy on consumer spending for years, and because most consumers haven't had an effective raise in decades while prices have gone up, and because the federal government pushed home ownership and the associated home equity loans, do you wonder why people overborrowed? She says, don't blame the American people personally, except perhaps for the fact that they elected a bunch of corporate shills to run their country and are now being punished for doing what they were taught to do. Lucy, thanks a lot. Lots of questions in that Facebook posting that we got from Lucy. Go ahead, Professor Guerin. What do you think?
I agree very strongly with Lucy that I don't think it is really the fault of the individual Americans. Indeed, the culture has changed, as I said, since World War II and particularly since the 1980s. And people, in a sense, feel a certain pressure as a good American to be spending and to be borrowing. Lucy's other point is also very important, that this the spending spree and the borrowing spree since the 1980s really was accompanied by growing income inequality and particularly wage stagnation among a huge part of the American working population. So what has happened since the 80s, but particularly since about 2000-2001, is that as wages have stagnated, Americans have actually looked to credit and more borrowing as the way to somehow make up the difference and to maintain a middle-class lifestyle even as their wages were stagnating, declining.
Yeah, and I wonder about that. Thank you, Lucy. Because you could say maybe Americans don't save because our health care is so expensive, there's nothing left over, or higher education is so expensive, there's nothing left over, or we don't really have public transit, so people drive to work and spend money on gas and auto maintenance. So a little bit more, if you could, Professor Guerin, on this idea that your average American isn't saving because their lives are very expensive, there's not a lot left over.
Well, I agree with that statement, too. And, of course, a large part of the book is comparative. And I look at other countries, other first world countries in Europe and in Japan. And, indeed, one finds something. I think the biggest surprise in my book was that I found that the welfare states of Europe, which, as you say, fund education, fund public transportation, fund health, that the savings rates are actually higher in these welfare states. And that's totally counterintuitive if you're an economist living in America. You actually believe, economists here believe, wrongly as it turns out, they think that welfare states and having Social Security and things like that will actually decrease the savings rate. But the European example shows us that when the Europeans actually keep people out of poverty, people naturally save more, but also when they have affordable public transportation, when they have higher education that is nearly free in Europe, and when they have every first world country in the world except for us has national health insurance or national health care, all of these things decrease the cost for individual households, and it seems to actually promote saving, exactly the opposite of what the economists told us.
Well, and here's another comment from our Facebook page from Jessica, who takes the opposite argument that Lucy does. Jessica says, I think people can definitely be blamed. Take personal responsibility for your money. Don't depend on the government to do it for you. Certainly, some Americans are taking out credit card debt to pay for an illness and the health care costs associated with it. But certainly, Professor Guerin, there must be plenty of people who are, you know, doing it to get a new car, even though they really don't need one.
Well, okay, I'm going to agree with that statement, too, if that makes me seem very
wishy-washy. Well, it's a big picture, so...
Yes. No, personal responsibility can be important. But what I think is very interesting is that if you took a person, if you could have a laboratory experiment, you had a person and you put them in America, and you say, took the same person and put them in Germany or Japan, they would behave very differently. They would not do the same thing because the culture, the incentive structure, the messages they're getting from the media, from government, even from their neighbors is very different. In Germany, people would be praised for being thrifty. They would be praised for not buying a bigger house than you need. They'd be praised for waiting until they actually had the savings to buy things. Whereas in America, if you live in a suburban neighborhood, you're keeping up with the Joneses. It's very intense pressure. When you go into a bank in America, at least before the 2008 crash, the banks were literally throwing money at people. You'd come in and say, I want a home equity loan on 80% of my equity, and they'd say, here, you can have it on 110% of your equity. These stories are very common. So while you can blame people for falling for these sort of things, people have not been very well protected from the predatory messages and practices that they encounter here.
Well, thanks, Jessica and Lucy. And I encourage others to post on our page as well. Join our conversation. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Another thought, again, we're starting to get into comparing Americans with people in other countries, especially talking about Europe right now. So Americans, Professor Guerin, are raised on the value of home ownership. We're told since we were little, you know, that's your best financial investment. many Europeans, as you know, are more likely to rent. There's just less housing stock available, and renting is more of an option for a lot of people. So we've got more money in our homes instead of our bank accounts. Is that a valid reason why our savings rates are lower? And is that okay?
Okay, two questions. It is a major reason why our savings rates are lower, because Americans since World War II have put a large amount of their surplus money into their homes, and particularly since the 1990s, when you had this big housing bubble, people put more and more money into their homes. They bought bigger and bigger homes. Now, federal policy has encouraged this since the 1930s. We have a structure really unlike most countries where, first of all, you have the FHA, Federal Housing, that guarantees loans for banks, so it keeps the interest rates fairly low. We get tax deductions for home mortgages, which is very unusual in the rest of the first world. And so if you want to get a contrast, in Germany and in Austria, home ownership is about 43%. In our country, it's about 68%. So it's very, very different. Home sizes. In our country, home sizes since 1950, the average house size has basically increased 2.5-fold. We're more than twice, sometimes almost three times as much as Europeans and Japanese in terms of the size of our houses. So when you have a bigger house, you got to put more stuff in it. You got to heat it. You got to cool it. You live in the suburbs. You need 2 to 3 cars, and of course a 2 to 3 car garage. You got to pay for the gas. So in all these ways, it's eroded our savings rate by calling for more and more consumption.
Well, lots of callers, and let's go to them now. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Guerin, first up is Michael in Concord. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
One comment and a question. The comment is, I think we've had a history of relative abundance compared to most other countries, and we are now the victims of the culture of relative abundance. And second, the question, you save in order to consume in the future. And we have a no down payment society. We have immediate consumption. It seems to me that many other countries have, if not laws, regulations, or policies that require a minimum down payment, particularly for large purchases like automobiles. And I think we've gotten into that now in the housing market. We've tightened up a little bit. But I wonder if you'd comment on that, because it seemed to me that most European countries had that kind of policy, and that's why they had much higher savings rates, or part of the reason.
Michael, two great points. And Professor Guerin, let's take the first one. I love this point, a history of relative abundance. He's right. I mean, post-World War II, you know, we weren't shattered. Our country was not devastated. We didn't have soldiers in the streets and this sort of, you know, fear of having to go without.
Very much. Excellent points from Michael. The abundance goes way back in American history. Certainly in the 1800s already, Americans were talking about why they were different from Europeans. They had abundance. At that point, it was mainly in terms of land, mineral resources. We could afford to spend more. People clearly had more property. And as you say, Laura, after World War II, the differences between us and the rest of the First World were stark. We came out with no war damage, with our factories humming, with living standards actually having improved during World War II in the United States, whereas everybody else, they were living in shattered cities in Japan, Germany, Britain, etc. So they coped with scarcity. And even today, of course, in Europe, right now, people are coping with limits and with austerity. So there was a notion, a pessimism, that you had to save in Europe or Japan because you didn't know what the future was and because resources and things around you were scarce. The other point that Michael brings up is so interesting, and that is the notion that one has to save now to consume later. And in fact, the Germans have a word, Konsumsparen, which literally means, savings based on consuming later. Whereas in America, we don't think we have to save to consume. We think we might save for a rainy day, but we don't have to save up for anything anymore because we can do it on credit. So I think it's a huge difference.
You know, getting back to that first point and the cultural ideas of, you know, you never know if something terrible could happen. It's often said, Professor Guerin, that Americans are an optimistic bunch. Is there something in our national character that says, you know, I probably won't lose my job, or someone else will have a health crisis but not me, that discourages us from saving for that rainy day?
Well, I think so. And of course, we find that savings really correlates with pessimism and spending with optimism. Americans are very optimistic. There are good grounds for that. We do have a much more flexible economy than the Europeans and the Japanese. People will move around a lot more in the United States to find jobs than they will in the rest of the first world. So I think a lot of our optimism is based on that. Of course, the problem is that the optimism is sometimes poorly placed. Right now, people probably should be a little more pessimistic. It's not so easy to move around now. People are trapped in their homes where the value of their homes may have dropped 20 or 30%, and they can't move so easily. So it's probably a time that Americans could use a healthy dose of pessimism, maybe not too much, but some.
Pessimism is healthy? We're not used to hearing that.
We're never used to hearing it. It's un-American.
Well, Michael, thanks a lot for those thoughts. And let's go now to Roger in Exeter. Hi, Roger. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Good morning. I heard about this show last week. I made a point of being in my office to listen to it. I am a financial planner, and I deal with people everywhere from middle class, let's say teachers, to upper middle class, dual income professionals, to what some might consider wealthy. I've done literally hundreds of cash flow analysis for clients, and the common thread is no one saves enough, and they can. I guess I really disagree with some of the premise that people are not responsible for their own financial lives, that they're somehow being pulled along by this culture that says they have to consume. There is plenty of room to save. I've seen it in people making $40,000 to $500,000. Their priorities are different. And as the professor said, what I see is they want to live in a bigger house than they grew up in. They want multiple cars. They want multiple phones, TVs, computers. And if that's your priority, fine, but you will not be able to fund your retirement. You will not be able to fund your child's education. So people need to make a decision. Do I go to Disney for 10 grand, or do I put money into my child's 529 plan?
Wow. Yeah,
and they are not doing that. And I contrast this, Laura, and this is for those out there that say, no, he's wrong, I can't save. I have clients that are second and third generation Asian Americans, and the contrasts are stark. They save, they sacrifice for their children. Education is number one. And when their children go to school, they major in things that ensure they can make a salary to pay back loans. And they save, again, the second generation, they're saving 20% of their salary. They're saving for children that aren't even born yet. And I contrast, you know, an Asian-American engineer making the same salary with an American-born engineer. So they're making the same amount of money, and somehow the Asian-American is able to do all this stuff. The American is choosing not to.
Well, Roger, yeah, this is a great point. Good to hear from you, given that you're right in this. And, you know, Roger, I'll tell you that Professor Guerin's book not only compares Americans to Europeans, but big chunk of the book, Professor Guerin, that compares us to Asian nations. So go ahead, Professor Guerin.
Roger's point is excellent. And again, I really do agree with that. I mean, it is a personal responsibility issue. And I agree with him that studies do show that Americans at all income levels are capable of saving. In fact, we see some very good savers among fairly poor people. I mean, it's a matter of economizing, sometimes severe economizing if you're at the lower end of the income scale. But it can be done. And I agree with Roger that people make certain choices that to me and clearly to Roger seem a little irrational and actually hurt them in the end. But I do come back to my point that if we didn't have these institutions that so encourage consumption and credit, I think we might have a somewhat different story. I don't think it's just human nature. I think it's that we don't protect Americans from themselves, from borrowing too much. And a lot of the European nations and Japan, there are more protections and more incentives to save.
So it's not that Asians and Europeans are innately more inclined to save and that culturally Americans are disinclined. It's that there are institutions, financial institutions, cultural messages, moral suasion that shapes our approach and our attitude towards savings.
Yes, I argue that in the book. In the book, one has to understand it's not just about the present. It's a long history. 200 years ago, nobody in the world had bank accounts. I mean, people might save their crops a little bit, but the modern habit of saving is really quite new. People had to learn it, and some societies in Europe and East Asia really pushed the savings habit, taught children how to save, taught adults how to save, discouraged over-reliance on consumption and spending. And we did something quite different.
And there are institutions in other countries that help you save. I mean, you know, for small investors, a lot of banks don't want to deal with, you know, my $500 gift that I got from grandma, you know. But there are institutions in France and Britain and Germany and South Korea where, sure, you know, bring me your $500. I'm happy to help you do it.
That's right. And there's a long history to this in which I talk about. Back in the 1800s, all of these governments in Japan and in Europe established a number of institutions that were friendly to these small savers, to people with not a lot of money to bring in. They didn't have minimum balance requirements. They didn't have the sort of obscene fees that we see in American banks today. These were called savings banks. They were called post office savings banks. If you go to Japan, the postal savings bank today is the world's largest bank in the world, not the world's largest postal bank, but the world's largest bank. It's so popular. In a number of European countries, you have post office savings as well. So you have this very accessible saving for young people and for lower income people. And as you say, our commercial banks here can be really, really mean toward the small saver. They hit them with fees. They hit them with minimum balance requirements. They make it quite difficult for lower income and young people to save.
Well, and just one more quick question for you. You know, Japan is a frequent example in your book, and you've got lots of experience with Japan. You've written other books about Japanese economics. But I got to say, Professor Guerin, you know, their economy has been kind of limping along for a couple decades now. I mean, do we really want to copy them?
We certainly don't want to copy every aspect of Japan, that's for sure. And you bring up a very good point. The economy has been stuck for two decades. Now, it could be that the Japanese oversaved at one point, and they probably should have done a little bit more consumption. But it's also true that the Japanese bubble, which, you know, was a lesson for us because it was the first big bubble to burst, and it burst around 1990, 1991. It had very bad consequences for Japan, but socially, people didn't lose their homes. There wasn't a foreclosure crisis. People didn't lose their jobs. They had national health insurance, so they kept their health up. So there has been a social stability in Japan that, in some sense, we might be envious of in our own country, because when our bubble burst, people lost their jobs, they lost their health insurance. In many cases, they lost everything.
So the Japanese at least had that cushion to fall back on, that personal cushion.
Exactly.
We will take more of your calls after a short break. More comments from our Facebook page, more emails. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
Today, Word of Mouth digs into the dueling legacies of Bill Clinton's presidency. A new documentary featuring loyal friends and sworn enemies fills out the portrait of a leader praised for great achievements and tainted by scandal. I'm Virginia Prescott. That story and warming up the February doldrums with music from the band Winter Pills on Word of Mouth. Today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members. M from Capital Center for the Arts in Concord, presenting the traditional Irish ensemble, Da Nu, with its blend of old and new Irish music. March 11th at 7:30, tickets at ccanh.com. And from the Hannah Grimes Business Incubator in Keene, helping entrepreneurs succeed with office space, support services, and educational programming. Details at hannahgrimes.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the author of a new book called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves. We're talking with Princeton University professor Sheldon Guerin and taking your questions and comments. Do you see some in your circle of family and friends living beyond their means? Do you find yourself doing it too? Why do you think that's the case? What might encourage Americans to save more? And if you're not originally from the U.S., what were the cultural attitudes toward consumption and thrift in your home country? Our number is 1-800-892-6477. 6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also join the conversation on our Facebook page. And Professor Guerin, I want to go right back to the phones and go to Philip in Kennebunk. Hi, Philip. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I'm just trying to make a comparison because I've moved from Yorkshire, England, in 1983, and came to the United States. And primarily lived in Florida, but now I've been in New England for 20 years. But I would say that the real difference is what we've talked about is true is the social safety net that Britain has. But what I find interesting, every time I've been going back, which is usually once a year, I see that the UK and the British people have done so much better, and it seems to me I see a lot more personal wealth and situations. But a friend of mine said it best. He said it's like Britain won the lottery with the everybody who owned a house owned the lottery when houses started to go up and they were tapping equity to live this lifestyle. So I think that's I think it's very true that we're following the same way. And I think if you look at the economic situation in UK, it warrants that. There's the spending we've been going through.
So, Philip, are you saying Brits do a better job saving than Americans, or we're about the same?
I say they did when I left in the 80s and 70s. I know personally my own family, my own father and mother were great savers. But I think what's happened is that because of, again, I think the last roll of the dice was the housing situation, because Britain's industry has been disappearing quickly, and they put all their eggs in the basket of urban development, and unfortunately, it's really kicked Britain in the teeth. But my only advice to anybody saving, and this is an Arab proverb, is that you should pay yourself 10% first. So when you get your wage salary, you pay yourself 10%, and then over your lifetime, that 10% becomes your slave.
Right.
Down the road. And I think if you just remember one thing, I don't think you can beat that system. I think it's worked for me.
Well, Philip, thank you for calling, and I'm glad he called because you mentioned Britain in your book, Professor Guerin. You say exactly what Philip says, don't you, about the shift in Britain?
That's right. And Britain is an interesting case because it's different from continental Europe. Now, up to about the 1950s or 60s, Britain was very much part of the European story or the Japanese story of lots of institutions that promoted saving, not that much borrowing. But in the 1980s, Britain, as Philip just suggested, began to follow, in some ways even lead the United States in terms of financial deregulation, in terms of massive investment in housing, and an ordinary consumers relying increasingly on consumer borrowing. So in many ways, Britain is much closer to the U.S. And by about 2000, Britain had very low saving rates, even lower than the United States in many years. Credit card usage in Britain is very high, home equity loans, and obviously major mortgages, and a big boom in housing prices that, as Philip suggested, made a lot of people fairly prosperous. Now, this has come to a halt in Britain, in a sense, not quite as bad as here. The housing bubble has not quite burst in Britain. Housing prices haven't collapsed. But the savings rate seems to be going up in Britain now. And Britain has one advantage the United States doesn't. It does, as Philip says, has a stronger safety net than we do, which means that even when people get in trouble with their debt in Britain, they still have national health care. It's actually quite difficult to foreclose on a homeowner in Britain. Banks are really required to work with homeowners, often to keep homeowners in their house, even if the homeowners then rent rather than own. So in many ways, Britain looks a lot like us, but tends to have some European characteristics in terms of a social net, a safety net, and how it copes with debt.
Well, and here's an email from Missy in Concord, again bringing up this point of Europe and the social safety net. She says, I think it would be easier for middle-class Americans to save more if they didn't have such large medical and college savings expenses. What are your guests' thoughts about the large percent of Americans' salaries that go toward health care and college savings? If these expenses were more subsidized by our government, as they are in many European countries, we would have more money to save. So that's Missy's thought, Professor Guerin. And then we had Roger earlier who called and said, no, 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 if you want to save, you really can. How do we figure this out? What's the right balance there?
Well, I think Missy has a very good point, though, that increasingly we do have to pay a lot of money for things that Europeans get at a very low cost. In some ways, even though American economists might say that Europeans or Japanese are inefficient, by actually pooling their resources for things like public transportation and national health insurance and higher education, they actually do bring down the overall cost per person. So I agree with Missy that that we just do have to pay for a lot of these things. I also agree with Roger, the financial planner, before that Americans don't necessarily spend all their money on health and education. They spend it on a lot of things that don't have much of a return in terms of their children's advancement later. Bigger homes, bigger cars, things like that. Those don't count as investments in anything.
Well, you know, and here's a question. We keep talking about Europe and, you know, what a great job individual Europeans do and how they have these little, you know, postal savings banks on every corner that encourage small investors, and how even when the economy tanks, people have that own personal cushion to fall back on. Yet at the macro level, Professor Guerin, you know where I'm going with this. You know, we hear that Europe is not doing so great. Every time you turn on the news, you hear Europe debt crisis. Even banks in, you know, prosperous countries like France are said to be teetering. So, again, should we really be looking at what they do as a model?
Well, everybody should always be looking at everybody else. If everybody around the world said, well, America has some problems, so there's no best practice we're going to look at in America, that would be very self-defeating. And by the same token, when we look at Europe and we put it in quotation marks and assume it's one place, that also gets us in trouble. I've heard so many people recently think that Greece is exactly the same as the rest of Europe. Greece is a basket case. It's a relatively small part of the economy. Now, Italy's a bigger part. But if you look at the northern tier of Europe, from France, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, Austria, Denmark, Sweden, these countries are doing pretty well. And even in the last quarter, when they were supposed to be going into free fall, although they did fall to about zero growth, but they didn't fall much further, and they seem to be leveling off. Germany has about 5 or 6% unemployment, much better than us. Half a million jobs in Germany are going wanting. These economies have learned how to stabilize in crises and do well during prosperity, and I think savings is a big part of the story. It's the French, the Germans, the Swedes, the Austrians, these successful economies that have the high savings. We're not talking about Greece now.
Let's take another call. This is Douglas waiting in Marlborough, Vermont. Douglas, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you, Laura, for taking my call. And
sure.
Thank you, Professor Guerin. I've been listening to a host of your talk show call-ins here, including Professor Guerin, and they've kind of pretty much covered everything I want to speak about. So I'm just going to state my point, and I'm going to defer to your host to continue on with your talks here. But you know, my basic premise is that I believe that the government of the United States isn't taking care of, and it's their duty to take care of its people here. And in many ways, like medical care, education, and, you know, maybe transportation. But I feel that as income has been flat for quite a, well, say a couple decades anyways, and it tends to be decreasing now, the cost of, I mean, where's the frontier going to be next to remedy this situation? And the only thing I can think of right now is the high cost of living, housing, autos, food, etc. And I just think it's something that should be looked at more seriously. And I think if not willingly, it will eventually be forced upon us to look at those areas. And I just want to comment on Greece versus the rest of Europe. I know that's another issue, but I think Greece was forced into the euro. And I think their economy was doing just fine before that.
Yeah, and you know, Douglas, we've done a lot of shows on the euro and all that, and it's a great, great avenue of conversation. But for now, I want to stick to what Sheldon Guerin's talking about. What do you think about his first point? You know, where's the next bump on this road?
Well, I think the bumps on the road, first of all, we have a huge problem among homeowners. Housing prices nationwide have collapsed about 30% from their peak before the bubble burst. What that has meant is lots of Americans were borrowing against their houses and spending on the assumption that the paper value of their house was their real wealth. We call this the wealth effect. And now that wealth has been taken away from them. They might still be in their homes, although 4 million people have lost their homes and 8 million more are in trouble. And this is a huge crisis because it means that they will, in a sense, be penniless, that they have no liquid saving, that a recent survey showed that 43% of American households had little or no savings. About 25% are deeply in debt. So this is a huge problem, and it's coming up. It's going to be a retirement problem soon because Americans not only don't have money now, but they haven't saved for retirement. Our Social Security system is designed to give people a minimal payment for retirement, but not to allow them to live the way they want to. So this is going to be a big crisis. Society, one way or another, is going to be forced to take care of a lot of fairly destitute older people. So there are big crises coming up, I believe.
So the housing crisis continues as people get stuck in their homes and perhaps they want to move. And then this, you know, silver tsunami, which we talk a lot about here in New Hampshire because we're in an older state.
Yeah.
All right, let's take another call. And this is Barbara in New Durham. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. Wonderful discussion this morning. I just would like to add to the discussion that we don't seem to be a culture that values delayed gratification.
And so, Barbara, that means that's why we don't save.
Well, yeah, because if you don't save and you can get everything now and no down payment and so on, it's not a major thing. It's a good part of it. But a lot of people are being brought up today that if you want it now, you get it now.
Yeah.
And I was brought up a long time ago, but the idea was if you value it, you save for it, you get it, you realize how much you value it and how exciting it is, and you really can appreciate it sometimes even more.
Barbara, did you ever put anything on layaway?
A long, long time
Yeah.
ago.
I remember putting a couple dresses on layaway as a teenager. So,
and you even take care of it
right.
more, I think. But it's pretty hard to get people to save if they also don't almost have that kind of behavior of even knowing what it's like to delay something.
Barbara, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Professor Guerin?
I agree with Barbara. I mean, two words have disappeared from the English language in the last 30 years, and they are saving up, to save up for something. It's a notion we used to have. You had a paper route, and you saved up to buy something. Again, if you went to European countries or Japan, the notion of saving up is very much there. There are words for it. In Germany, if you want to buy a house, you actually go to what's called a building society bank, and you start a building account where about for 5 years, you save up for a down payment as much as 30%. And then when the bank deems that you have saved up properly, then they loan you the rest. In Europe, the notion, when you ask people in a survey, why do you save? Well, Americans would say, I'm saving for retirement or a rainy day. Europeans will say, I'm saving to buy something in a year or two. I'm saving up for a vacation. So the idea that you don't borrow for these consumer needs, you save up for them. Very different notions, and Americans clearly have lost this notion of saving up.
Well, it's so easy for us to borrow, as you said earlier.
Very easy.
I had heard, though, that over this past holiday season anyway, that there was a return in the old-fashioned layaway system, and that you even saw some banks offering Christmas clubs. Remember those where in January you'd put away, okay, you know, $20 a month, and by Christmas, lo and behold, you had some money to buy Christmas presents. So have we seen a little bit of this return to this ethic Barbara talks about?
Well, I didn't know about the Christmas clubs. I haven't seen anything locally. But it is true that layaway is returning. It's a necessity, particularly for lower-income people or middle-income people who now have lost a lot. I hope your listeners know what layaway is, but basically it is a savings plan that the store has that you don't get the item until you have saved up on a monthly basis. I think it's coming back because in many ways it's the only way people can buy things, and it is the reverse of the credit card or the reverse of the installment plan where you get the item now and you have the debt later.
Yeah, you put down like $5, and then every couple weeks you go in and put another $10 down on the dress. And I remember the excitement of going in, okay, I've got $10, you know, I can put it down on the dress now. You know, you say in the book, Professor Guerin, if there's one thing we've learned from the financial crisis, again, it's that we spend too much, save too little. What do you think? I mean, several years out from the beginning of this crisis, have we learned that lesson?
I'm not sure we have learned it.
Really?
After 2008, there was a big spike in the personal saving rate in the United States. We had been almost at zero, at about 1% or so, and the savings rates went up some months even above 6%, but generally annually is about between 5 and 6%. And so the media touted this in 2008 and 2009, and they talked about Americans were adopting a new frugality or returning to their traditional thrift. I thought it was overplayed at the time. We still don't have very good surveys since 2008, but what I think happened was that the more affluent more affluent Americans who control a lot of the wealth in this country, they suddenly curtailed their spending and started saving. And because, of course, they had the margin to save, that showed up in the national statistics as indicating that all of us were saving more. And indeed, when you look at middle and lower income households, there doesn't seem to have been a dramatic increase in saving, a little bit paying down debt. But most Americans, middle and lower, felt were really trapped, and they haven't increased their savings much. And now I think credit's coming back, and we may have the same problems all over again.
Well, Professor Guerin, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. It's been a pleasure to be on.
That's Sheldon Guerin. He's a professor of history at Princeton University. In addition to Beyond Our Means, the book we talked about today, he's written several books on Japanese economics. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Join our page to continue the conversation. Learn more about what we're doing every day. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy. We'll be right back.